Abby fucking Martin.
Welcome to the Holy Habibi shit. House podcast.
We're gonna have to bleep that one out.
Very special guest.
Right out of the gate. You're already bleeping.
I mean, you're a legend.
Oh, come on.
Give her the proper introduction.
Oh, all right,
we got something written. It's probably ChatGPT.
ChatGPT, we don't use that over here. Do we? I don't.
Who doesn't?
All right, today's guest is someone who doesn't report the news. She dissects the empire and puts the truth on blast.
Hell yeah.
Abby Martin is an investigative journalist, the creator and the host of The Empire Files, and a leading voice in independent media. Her 2019 documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom, exposed whatever that word
2019.
Is. War crimes. War
that
crimes.
Era
with
war crimes.
Yeah. The occupation war crimes with such clarity, it's been called one of the most important films on Palestine ever made. And in 2025, she followed it up with Earth's Greatest Enemy, a gut punch look at U.S. militarism and climate collapse.
Legend. Welcome.
Her video.
Not yet.
Oh, wait. Paragraph two.
More. Don't.
Yeah.
Cut me short.
Honestly, you know.
But wait.
Go on.
Yeah. Her video series on Palestine, Israel, or Palestine occupation. Has been hailed as
it was ChatGPT.
Yeah.
God damn it! Yeah. I said,
"What are you deciding?"
Palestine occupation has been hailed as the definitive crash course on the occupation. Whether she's on the ground in Gaza or grilling U.S. officials, Abby's uncompromising style and fearless reporting have made her a standard bearer of advocacy journalism and one of the most well-known independent voices in the country.
What else?
She's been blacklisted. Uh-huh. She's been targeted.
Yep.
She's been silenced.
Yep.
And yet she's louder than ever. Ah. Abby Martin, welcome to the Habibi House.
Yeah, what an intro.
Clap now.
Damn, that was like the best intro I ever
Let's
got.
Let's go. Legend. Fearless. Yeah. You know, Abby Martin.
A little bit of, anyway.
How do I live up to that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
just exists.
You already have.
Yeah.
You are the living testament.
And do you guys want to? We have our sponsor plug too.
Oh yeah,
to make this episode possible.
Oh my god!
Sponsored by Chorus.
Yeah,
man, I love this shirt. I love the color. What do you think?
Gorgeous. And I mean, I'm gorgeous. So thrilled about my new sweatshirt. It is beautiful.
Sick, right?
And there's a lot.
Absolutely
they're
gorgeous.
They're probably hit you up individually to send you more.
Dude,
so.
It's epic.
And for those who don't know, Chorus, it's a premium streetwear brand redefining tradition through fashion. So they blend a lot of Tortuguese like elements and old school design with modern fashion. So it's very rooted in our culture. It's founded by a Palestinian designer. Designed in New York City and produced with an Arab-owned supply chain. So every thread tells a story, and as a thank you to our listeners, Chorus, as always, is offering 20% off of your purchase.
What?
With the code
Habibi
20.
20
at checkout.
Habibi 20. And shirt's so good, your friends will want to steal it from right off your back.
Straight up.
You know,
so comfy. And it's like one of those really high quality sweatshirts too. It's not like a it's like you could tell it's thick and made with love.
And warm.
All right, Abby Martin, what the hell is going on in the world?
God, man.
Yeah,
where
we
start?
I mean, we got an emergency topic, right?
Yeah, flotilla, right? Or freedom flotilla.
Freedom flotilla.
Yeah, what is the freedom flotilla? And
how do we get on the boat?
And
how do we get there?
What happened to the boat? Yeah. What's the history of the Freedom Flotilla?
What happened last night?
Yeah, the Freedom Flotilla is it's an international effort, a coalition of dozens of countries, solidarity activists from dozens of countries who for over 15 years have been trying to break the illegal siege of Gaza by taking a boat straight to Gaza and delivering aid themselves. Now, what's really fascinating about this is back in 2010.
Is this the one that what Turkey sent out that also got attacked and raided?
And I want to talk about that one because that is actually what catalyzed my awakening about Palestine.
Oh, wow.
2010?
Was the 2010 flotilla attack.
Really?
And so to preface what just happened last night, mm-hmm. Which is Israel attacked another flotilla, I want to talk about what happened in 2010 really quickly because this wasn't the first time.
Okay.
2010, a coalition of international solidarity activists were on the boat. They were going to Gaza. In international waters, an Israeli helicopter commandeered the ship.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of commandos got out. Executed 10 people at least on board.
Yeah, I remember this.
Including an American citizen, not saying that their lives are worth anymore, but the fact that our fucking government
didn't say anything.
And the media's distortion about it woke me up. I was watching the media.
Yeah, what was it? What were they saying?
They were playing the Israeli propaganda video just straight up. And the Israeli propaganda video was circling the people on board that were trying to fend off the attackers with tables and chairs and circling them saying these are weapons. And I was like, those are not weapons. They got killed. How could they not fight back? And my brain like didn't stop functioning. Yeah. I was like, none of this makes sense. Yeah. And all of a sudden, black was white, up was down, never looked back. I was like, this is, if they do this and the media covers for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's really incredible.
I can't believe this is Abby Martin's origin story.
And then last night,
they try to do it again.
I mean, I've been so invested ever since I woke up with this story and motivated by the fact that there's humanitarians that are selfless enough to put their bodies on the line, their lives on the line to do this. Yeah. And so I've been closely following this. They wanted me on the boat. I couldn't go. So I've been in close contact with these people. It's been very classified under the radar because we know how crazy draconian Israeli surveillance technology is. So they've been very DL, which is even scarier. What happened? Sorry for the preamble, but what happened is that they launched off the coast of Malta last night. 12 miles away from the coast of Malta, a C-130 Israeli military aircraft was tracked, flying around about 5,000 feet at low altitude for hours. Right. And then this military plane has the capability of dispatching quad drones, so smaller drones that can be deployed. And that's the drones that we think attacked the boat.
Are those the suicide drones that just go and explode?
They are the drones that they could shoot people. Reports of them emanating like crying babies.
They're shooting.
And so the anonymity of using drones to do this, I was super worried. I was like, the plausible deniability of them just using drones, they could just be like,
right,
we have no idea who did this. But
yeah, they've never been, the C-130 Hercules has never been near Malta before. It's like the first time it's ever happened.
That is insane.
So obviously there's no way to like deny that they did that.
And they've taken credit for it.
And then Israeli media this morning, even though U.S. media is just saying alleged drone attack on the boat.
Alleged.
The imaginary. Israeli media is running with it. Israel attacks boat.
Wait, so this boat was going from Malta to Gaza?
Yeah, and it's 2,000 miles away from Gaza. So that's what's so unprecedented about this.
Before they could even like get out of
it. Dude, you look at where it is. It's literally across the Mediterranean.
What the heck?
Like across the ocean.
Yeah. On what sovereignty can you go and attack a humanitarian boat?
It's an act of war.
It's in international waters. It's definitely another war crime. And each one of these things is, you know, precedent enough to like make,
what's the point?
The whole world. Like,
they tried to sink the boat. They tried to sink the boat with 30 people on board. They tried to kill 30 people on board.
How could you possibly hide behind, if you want to maintain any type of legitimacy?
Well, we're not shocked anymore, are we?
Yeah, right.
So, and the thing is, the 2010, massacre is not the first time with the, obviously the original time is the USS Liberty where, you know, they straight up, attacked an actual American boat.
Yeah.
An American boat, not just like a humanitarian boat.
Like an actual military.
Yeah, like a military boat. So, like, that's kind of that was the turning point for a lot of veterans is learning about it. Because we didn't learn about that in school. We didn't learn that Israel literally attacked an American boat and then they never got any repercussions for that. And that happened in the 60s. So obviously social media wasn't a thing back then. So now we have it live streamed where like Jacob Berger, for example, is literally on stream, like saying like, hey, any government, please come help us.
That was crazy to see our boy Jacob.
Like, yeah. And other people
in danger even,
there's a few other, public figures on there pleading to like have this boat saved. And,
Okay. I mean, they were abandoned for hours out there, you guys. Malta, like, this is super sketchy because Malta had to have coordinated with Israel to do this strike, dude.
Okay.
And they denied the SOS calls for hours. That was the whole thing. I mean, I was up last night till 5 trying to coordinate all the press, and they were just like, Malta is not responding to our calls. The boat is sinking for hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Where are they at now? I mean,
they are still trying to get back into Malta. Maltese Coast Guard are like, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And then on the flip side of that, where there's the other topic is the fires that are happening in Israel. So, it's staying true to their name. And then the irony of it all is that they're literally they're asking for help from like the countries that they destroyed around them, which is like comical at best, that they're like pleading for, helicopters to come in and help them with the firefighting efforts. And they try to blame it on Palestinians, but then there's literal video evidence of
every day
Israelis doing it.
So. Every day I see settlers lighting olive trees on fire.
Straight up.
Literally.
And it goes back to your Earth's Greatest Enemy documentary,
mm-hmm.
where like their wars that they wage nonstop is going to affect their own health too.
Yeah.
Yes. Just, yeah.
So what do you, he's going to speak to Farah's from
Farah Nabulsi.
Nabulsi, the director that came on our show last episode, was speaking about how, you know, when you try to burn down essentially the world, you know, she gave an analogy. It's akin to burning down like rooms and curtains and stuff in your own house. Eventually, it's going to light you on fire as well, and your whole house is going to burn down. So you can't escape, you know, the colonial grip doesn't escape itself.
I mean, it's absolutely crazy, even just looking from like a complete selfish mentality of just Israelis living adjacent to the most bombed, densely populated area that has been completely toxified by this campaign. I mean, even just from that angle, it's shocking that out of just pure self-preservation, they wouldn't want to stop.
Right.
Especially wanting to retake the land and colonize it. It's like, don't you want to survive? Like, you guys got fucked. You guys fucked yourselves.
Shut up.
Like, this is the most, this is bigger than Dresden. This is bigger than Hiroshima. I mean, this is like compounding all of those and
so
multiplying them.
Waste.
So is that what your documentary, like, what is it?
The documentary, it started off as just an exploration of carbon emissions. Because I think we hear that statistic often, like the U.S. military is the largest polluting institution on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And that's just based on how much oil they purchase every day, which is crazy. And so when you just look at that and you try to calculate the emissions based on the oil purchases, it gets really nuts because they don't have to actually compute it at all. Mm. And at all these climate conferences, the military is exempt. Mm. And so none of it's counted in any of these treaties. And so it's totally fake. It's all a mock. It's like making a mockery of the entire process. And so once I learned that, I was like, okay, this needs to be a film. We need to go confront these people. I went to COP26 in Glasgow and I was like confronting Nancy Pelosi. How could you not count these? How is Governor Jay Inslee, who's trying to be on the forefront of climate change, telling me that the military is the solution? And that's what these people think. To your point, that's literally what their answer was the military is the solution for climate change, because all they've seeded is that they need to ramp up the militarization of the border to anticipate what they know is coming, the exodus of refugees
because of
what they've done.
Yeah.
And basically the U.S. military, I mean, the whole film became so much bigger than just climate change, because it's like everywhere there's a base, it's a dumping ground. Everywhere there's a base, it's a sacrifice zone. And so going to Okinawa, going to Guam, going to Alaska and talking to the indigenous people there and just realizing the extent of the damage and how every base, every of the thousand bases around the world, that's the story.
What is the extent of the damage that you found?
There's, first of all, just the scale of the U.S. military's arsenal is the problem. Mm. Like, aside from the legacy of war and contamination of what Israel has done.
The current continuing scale.
The actual scale of having a military empire at this size. Mm. The amount of chemicals that they use to just clean the engines every day and dumping the toxic waste into the soil. I mean, just that alone.
Before even deploying the weapons.
Yeah, the volatile organic chemicals and the PFAS and all this shit. I mean, it's endless, you guys. So the movie's the totality of this. It's supposed to be like a one-stop shop, kind of like Gaza Fights for Freedom was. Like, here's everything you need to know, and we need to fight this monster now.
And comparing it to, like, when pretty much the only nuke that's ever been done in Japan twice, the amount of TNT equals 6 of those.
Yeah.
In Gaza, in over 2 years, right?
Yeah.
And then on top of that, going back to what you said about the U.S., when they were testing the Manhattan Project back in New Mexico, I just saw some article about how there's like the forgotten people in the outskirts of that testing. Yeah, the testing grounds where they died of, they were like the first people to die of radiation poisoning and the effects, the aftermath of those tests too. So yeah, we're the U.S. is, as you said, the number one reason for all this climate change. Yeah. And then they're like, we're the also the fixing, you know, we're the people that are going to fix it too.
It's so, like they don't care about the environment.
Yeah.
They're not like, the stewards of the ocean that they told us they were.
It's like they're making money off of this.
Yeah.
Should we ask somebody about this? Can we make a report to HR?
Yeah.
Well, where's our money going? Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, America, the American Empire is like, built upon imperialism and the military industrial complex and destroying things and, you know, insider trading and all that. And, you know, like, so what would happen if we removed all that? Like, would the American Empire would fall, right? Like,
you mean if we closed down the bases and the infrastructure?
Yeah. Like, is there any way to fix it? Because once we're like, we are the superpower.
Well, that's the problem is that the military superiority is so all-encompassing, and imperialism relies on U.S. military superiority. Right. And so we've gotten ourselves in a situation where the role and the reach of the U.S. empire is unmatched by any empire in human history.
Mm-hmm. It's like it's 10 the most times more weapons.
Violent, technologically advanced military empire we've ever seen, and it has a scale and scope that is unbelievable.
Yeah. I'm just curious because, like, we haven't, for example, like, we're seeing Russia's capability in Ukraine and vice versa, and all their, like, you know, that can be called a war because they're kind of at, you know, similar, you know, weapons and firepower. But for example, like, we haven't seen China in a war. You know, we say that America is the best and this and that, but I don't think we've seen other superpowers and their capabilities yet. I feel like China's just chilling, like, yeah, try us. You know, like, dude. You know, so I think there's a little bit of a Cold War situation going on there. And obviously with other powers, like even Iran, we haven't seen Iran and their, like, power, essentially. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen North Korea. I'm not going to sit here and say, like, I'm a military, like, but I'm curious.
No, you're right.
We're seeing India and Pakistan almost going to go into a full-scale war, and they're both nuclear powers too. So, I mean,
we're at the precipice a lot. Yeah.
The crossroads.
But, this is where, like, the movie gets good. Yeah.
But like you said, I mean, it is kind of all about China, and that's what this is all leading to.
Okay,
so you
Trump.
Have this China. See this kind of fracturing in the establishment over Russia. Like, you have, like, the pro-Russia faction and the anti-Russia faction, but it all of it is a stepping stone. The pro-China kind of Trump people who are more about, like, normalization with Russia, they just want Russia on their side so they can kind of corner China. They realize the problem of isolating Russia and making China and Russia's allyship stronger. But you're right. I mean, the Asia pivot during the Obama administration, Obama went to Egypt to kind of try to close out the war on terror and make this big grandiose speech. And that was because they were all pivoting over to China. And so you see a lot of escalation in the Red Sea, a lot of bases being built around China. And that's kind of the movie, going to Okinawa, going to Guam, going to the Mariana Islands chain, and realizing the ramping up of militarization to basically just sacrifice all these people as the front lines if there is a war that breaks out.
So how does the middle
old, the Cold War?
What's that?
Is this like the next Cold War?
I mean, we're in it.
It's pretty warm. The water's lukewarm. How does the Middle East have to do with all this? Because I've heard people say that, like, the Middle East is just another pawn. If America doesn't control it, then China and Russia will.
Center, and it's kind of the center of everything.
Well, what do you think about that?
It's the most important geostrategic access to resources in the world. I mean, look, as much as we want to pretend like, I don't know if we pretend that, but that war is about oil. It still is, and it has been for a long time. And I've talked to several generals who just tell me straight up, like at these conferences, like they're just straight up. They're like Israelis. They're just like, oh, yeah, we'll be honest with you. The establishment wants to placate us and pretend like they're being environmental stewards and they're looking at all these renewable energy sources. No, it's all about fossil fuel infrastructure and maintaining this global infrastructure to extract fossil fuels. And then what do you know? The military, once you extract the fossil fuels, you need more. And so you have to keep maintaining these occupations in Syria and Iraq. And that's exactly why Israel is such a necessary military garrison for the empire. It is our military garrison, and we need it to keep all of our enemies in check all around that area because we need that oil.
But is it just the oil that they're after, you think?
I mean, it's a lot. I think it's the oil. I think it's tamping down on independence movements like we saw with Nasser in Egypt in the 60s and 70s. I think that's when U.S. realized the utility of Israel more so than just kind of, a garrison there. Like, you could actually do our dirty work for us. Mm. We don't just have to own you as a colonial outpost and a military garrison. You could actually do this shit for us.
So who controls who then?
Oh, the U.S. controls everything. Israel would be nothing without the U.S.
But isn't the U.S. fairly influenced?
Well, you heard that also? No, I mean, even the whole Biden thing, he never asked for a ceasefire. Did you hear that news recently? Oh, yeah. I mean, we knew that. We knew it. But still, like, they're like, oh, we love Biden. So it was Biden's.
What a monster. Well,
he's been saying that he's a Zionist since the 70s. So, I mean, we didn't expect much from him.
But do you think it was the right decision to vote him out now, looking back?
Oh, I think
I'm saying the Harrison.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, I think asking anyone with a conscience, let alone Palestinians and Arabs, how fucking dare they to look down on your community and say you need to vote for the people committing genocide for the past year.
They didn't.
But are we?
That
they didn't.
Sick,
are we, of course, of oh. course. But are we better off? Now
there's one silver lining.
They didn't even want to win. Yep. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, come. Yeah.
I think the better question is why did they self sabotage instead of why didn't
because Trump is easier in? Is Trump is easier to be like, oh, he's crazy, we can't control it, and because they were being held accountable, that administration, they're withholding the votes from the Biden or Kamala people. But I feel like with Trump, they could just kind of do whatever they want. Like, the whole establishment, they're all on the same side.
It feels like there's less
resistance. Yeah, and they love it because they can pretend like they're fighting fascism. All the liberals, they love it.
Sit on the steps and say.
Yeah, they love not being in power because they're just like, oh, yeah, we're the underdogs. We're the renegades.
Yeah, they switch sides.
It seems like there's even less restraint from this administration and more free reign for Israel.
Oh, 100%. I mean, Trump is a complete psychopath. I mean, he has no moral compass at all. He has no ideology driving him at all. He's a complete empty vehicle for who his donors are. And that's almost scarier because Marion Adelson and Elon Musk, my God, I think that's where this whole deportation drive of quote unquote pro-Hamas sympathizers is, because they just want, he's just like, okay, what do you want? You gave me how many millions of dollars? All right, what's the first thing you want me to do? Sure. It's just literally just...
Yeah,
unbelievable.
The conflation of pro, Palestine, anyone that supports the Palestinian cause, and immediately being labeled as pro terrorism.
They were also, Israel actually said that about the boat. They were like, there was Hamas sympathizers on board.
That's the go-to.
It's becoming so just a standard labeling. It's scary.
Did you hear funny thing about Jared Kushner, because he's such a
there's something funny
cuck.
About Jared Kushner.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than him Jared being a cuck, Kushner, yeah. He probably lets Netanyahu fuck his wife. But but he does let Netanyahu come, and he had the craziest story is that his childhood bedroom, this is how close Jared Kushner's family was with Netanyahu. Netanyahu would come and stay in Jared Kushner's childhood bedroom.
What?
Why would you want to do that? If you're a prime minister of a country, wouldn't you want to stay in the Trump Hotel? Give me the suite. Why are you staying in a bunk bed of a 10-year-old's bedroom? It's a little strange, dude.
Wait, what? That's crazy.
Straight up.
So
very strange. Almost too strange.
Just he comes and just unloads his dirty laundry at the white. You guys saw that.
It's
the only foreign leader that comes with dirty clothes and multiple suitcases and just dumps it on the White House. And he's like, do my fucking laundry.
Really? Yeah. Laundry?
Yeah.
Dirty laundry. To the White House.
God,
I wish I were making this. No dry cleaner in the neighborhood?
So made up. Well, yeah, Jared Kushner's bedroom. Okay. Laundry.
The only thing that
check me now.
No, I've heard this before, actually.
The only thing I would say is that the silver lining to the Trump presidency is that, as I say, with cancer, it needs to be brought to the surface to excise it. And to see what somebody is capable of, it needs to be out in the open. With the Democrats, with Biden, it's always everyone's at peace. Oh, okay, we're not seeing crazy tweets every day, all this stuff. Everything's fine, right? But all the back room dealings and stuff keep happening, and we just are not privy to it. With Trump, everything's out in the open. And now there's people who are pro-Trump that are now holy shit, what's going on? You're seeing the El Salvador stuff. You're seeing, the deportations. You're seeing all of that. So now we can do something about it.
Yeah.
Does free speech exist?
Soon it might not. I mean, we're at a very dangerous moment.
Uh-huh.
This is kind of an unprecedented, we're in uncharted territory right now. I mean, we haven't seen, well, that's not very true. I mean, look at the Palmer raids, look at the Red Scare. I mean, people were deported for allegedly communists, you know, having communist sympathies back then. So no, it's not totally unprecedented. It is just so shocking that this could happen now after we've been through those moments of reckoning in our history.
Yeah. Yeah.
To absolutely. Now be faced with right. this. But well, you're right. I mean, liberals are the doormat to fascism.
Yeah.
Liberals have given, I mean, the status quoists have given us Trump. We knew that this was an inevitability. Voting for Kamala was just staving off the next Trump.
Yeah. So hopefully now that this happened, it'll never happen again. And we just need people to actually wake up and mobilize
and reject the two-party system. They don't give a shit
what
about
is the alternative.
It's like it's full-blown Zionist versus liberal Zionist. That's what we got with the two-party system.
The alternative is ranked choice voting. We just did it in Portland. Yeah.
What is
it? Ranked choice voting is where you can actually vote third party and not be browbeaten about it being like a spoiler or whatever, because you literally everything's ranked, so you can actually have multiple choices. And so we did that in Portland, and immediately like 4 DSA candidates got on city council and they blocked some big funding to Israel because of the pro-Palestine stuff. So it like, I mean, this is possible locally. I think federally, nationally, you look at and you're just so demoralized by seeing how crazy everything is, but we have to act locally.
So start at the local level
and get these measures passed. So then you can just regain control of your city councils. You can stop the Israel bonds. You can stop all of this locally. That's the only power that we have.
Right. So,
and of course, general strike. I mean, abandoning the third party, like, I'm sorry, the two party system. It's a duopoly. Yeah. Sure. It always has been. Yeah. It's a mafia.
Abby Martin, are you, or is this your first Arab American or Arab podcast?
It is.
Is it?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I'm so excited.
You know, we say like people talk about us, but now you're talking with us.
Yeah, I love it.
So,
more than an honor.
Yeah, it's great.
Do you have any favorite Arabic words or food?
I mean, like we were talking about before with the DJ. Can we talk about that really quick?
Yeah.
First talk about what he did and how, I mean, on Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh, yeah. He brought Lube or something. And he was like this.
After being silent. He's like probably one of the most prominent Palestinians in the world, right?
His cousin just came out and started calling him out, too. He's the volunteer that he's like, yo, my cousin's a piece of shit, basically.
You went on the podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, the funniest story is when someone gave me Mac Lube and they're like, do it. I was like, oh God, am I going to ruin dinner for 20 people or am I going to successfully flip this? And I did.
Is it on camera?
I did.
You got it?
It is on camera. Yeah. No,
did you
beautiful.
Do the tray above the pot?
Yes.
Mechanism?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's too risky.
And then someone was down below trying to catch it in case I fucked up to try to salvage it.
I feel like you got to work out for the, like, I saw Rania.
Oh, yeah. I was like, oh, my God. Like, I got to do
really Yeah, Rania Khalik is the CrossFit, you know, to do the matlupas.
I didn't know how heavy it was. I was like, God damn, it's like a 60-pound dish, dude.
Those old ladies be
they're
doing
like,
it all.
Their shoulders
they're
are
stacked,
like this big. Yeah,
stacked. Man.
Well, yeah. Do you have a is matluba the favorite?
I mean, I think it is just because. I mean, dude, all Palestinian food is the most amazing food I've ever had. I have the Palestinian 101 cookbook from my beautiful friend, and I just cook food from it every single day. Like I am obsessed. Zaatar, can't live without it.
Yeah,
you put it on fucking anything, man.
Yeah, seriously,
it's the best.
So okay.
Yeah, Zaatar.
I think you're one of us.
Yeah, Abigail,
give me an Arabic name.
Abby, Abir.
Abir.
Yeah. Abir, Matluba.
No, Abir, just the first name. Abir. Because that's the closest
to. I like that.
Abir.
Abir.
AB.
It's either way.
Are you Arab?
You were famous for your like videos interviewing people on the streets. I've seen them. You kind of, you know, inspiration. When did you first do that, and like how, like what did you learn from it? Also,
when did I first do it in general?
Yeah,
you know, I was totally awakened after the Iraq War of just how insanely complicit our media was in selling the war, and so out of necessity, I became a citizen journalist because I was like, you can't be an activist on the street corner. No one's going to listen to you. We have to retake the modes of communication. We have to be the media. Mm-hmm. And so this was a couple years before Occupy, but I just always felt like Man on the Streets, like Vox Pops, just shows the best random snapshot of any moment in time. Mm. And when Occupy erupted in my backyard and Oakland became like an occupied zone from the police.
So Occupy Wall Street?
Occupy Wall Street was kind of where everything synthesized, and that's how I got recognized by Russia Today and doing a lot of Man on the Streets there and just reporting daily on the police attacks. But I always do that. Everywhere I go, I always interview people because I always just find it so fascinating. And it's really important to me because, you know, I'll be told something from my government or the corporate media about Venezuela or Korea or whatever. And so I'll go and I'll just talk to Venezuelans. You tell me what you know, is this true?
Yeah.
Is this a dictatorship? Is there no food? And, you know, and the people just be like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just absolutely amazing. I encourage everyone to like, do that. Yeah, I think it's the best thing ever. But doing it in Israel was quite interesting because I did not expect those answers. I truly did not. I went to Palestine not, you know, motivated, of course, and thinking that I knew how bad it was. I had no idea how bad it was until I went.
Really?
I always thought two-state solution, right? And then you go to the West Bank, you're like, what state?
Yeah.
There's no state left.
Uh-huh.
It's gone.
Yeah. So fragmented.
So fragmented. And then Gaza's over there and Jerusalem. It's like, right. I don't, how would that work? And so it kind of like dawned on me of just how fucked up it was. And I'll never forget. And Jesus Christ, I don't want to cry. I told myself, do not cry in this podcast. But
it'll be good for views.
No, but I remember driving and just seeing over the hill, the Dome of the Rock. And my friend was just like, I can't go there. I can't go pray at our holiest site. And I was just like, or talking odd to Mimi. And I was just like, what are you, you know, Nabi Saleh, the little village that just gets attacked by settlers and soldiers every week. I was just like, what do you want to do with your life? She's like, I want to go to the beach. Beach is 10 kilometers away. Wow. And she's never been. And so those stories, I was just like, I couldn't believe it. And then going into, you know, spending several weeks there and all the Palestinians were just the most gracious, humble, beautiful people. Come into our homes. We'll make food for you all night. We'll tell you our stories. We love Americans. Come in. Right. Why do you love me? My government's killing you.
Yeah.
Because they can differentiate. They're not Americans. They don't just blame everyone. Right. And so going into Jerusalem for just several hours, I was not expecting how crazy it was. My friend Dan Cohen, who is an anti-Zionist Jew who was living in the West Bank, he was like, you want to see something fucked up? Let's go talk to Israelis. Mm. And he was like, they are so genocidal. He was like, swear to God, let's just do Man on the Streets for a couple hours and just see what we can get. I could not believe it. Like, I felt physically ill. I couldn't even be there. I was like, I don't want to spend a dollar here, dude.
Sounds nightmarish, just the idea of it.
It was. And I mean, you just watch the video. Just watch the video. Every single person I talked to spewed genocidal rhetoric and bloodlust.
Right.
It was either openly advocating ethnic cleansing or literally saying we should carpet bomb and kill them. And this was a period of relative calm in 2016.
Yeah. 2016. Yeah. And how do you feel when you're standing there and talking to them? You're just, because it's like,
I feel like, you know.
Yeah, because it's like you want the world to, you want them to say how they really feel, but.
And that was what was interesting. You know? I went in there really carefully because I didn't want to lead anyone.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just like, what do you think about the situation?
Mm-hmm. That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that's all it took. You know, and you're just sitting there and it's like, I have the tendency to kind of like nod along. And I just like at a certain point, I was just like, I'm like nodding along.
Yeah.
Saying like, it's just so.
100%.
And you're just like looking at this guy who looks like
Because you're nodding because you're like, come on, keep going.
Yeah, but then I'm like, oh my God.
Oh, so you want to kill them all? Like, I get it.
Yeah. And then I'm talking to this like guy who looks like he's just like from Palo Alto with glasses on, checkered shirt. And he's just like, he looks right in the camera. He's like, we should carpet bomb them. I'm like, what? And he was like, we should have the right to hate them. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Is that from the education, the brain? Like the because they're taught
from cradle to grave, dude.
And I think it's the impunity. They have fear. They can say whatever they want, and they just want to see how much they can get away. I think it's like a major ego thing.
Why is this the only context where those types of statements don't create mass outrages and worldwide condemnation.
You know why? And there's, ask yourself this, why have we never just seen Israelis talking? It's always these manicured spokespeople trotted British out on accents. Western media with American and British accents who tell us the perfectly sanitized two-state solution. We're working for this, we're working for that. Behind the scenes, we know how.
Yeah, compared to their
unabashed,
their media
and their society is.
And then the second you do it to them, it's like anti-Semitism, or, you know, they're like, oh my gosh, you guys are trying to kill us. Do you want to kill all Jews?
Yeah. And then they'll be like, you cherry pick these interviews. Yeah. How dare you paint us with a broad brush? It's like, well, this is reflected actually in polling. I don't have to generalize society. And no, they weren't cherry picked. I wish they were, but you just look at polling, especially after October 7th, and it gets really dark.
You haven't done an interview in many months. You said about 7 months. There's so much to talk about, but I think you were telling me that you had just watched The Settlers, the BBC documentary that literally on the plane. How did you feel? Were you like shaking in your seat? Or was it just like you weren't surprised?
I'll preface this by saying I do love Louis Theroux, and he did this in 2011 where he went and interviewed the ultra extremist settlers, and that was very revealing. And this is what he does. He goes and he'll interview, you know, the people in America who have the chimps and stuff. Like, he does that. He'll go to the Westboro Baptist Church and just be like, talk. And he does that very well. And so in a sense that it's like, we, you know, that's his style of journalism, and it's open for interpretation, whatever the people give you who he's interviewing. I think because it's on BBC, of course, you're going to kind of have that overall general notion of just liberal Zionism, kind of, which is, you know, he didn't do that, but what was most telling about the documentary, of course, not only how fanatical these settlers are and how easy it is, they're basically the vanguard of the entire country, because everyone can denounce them as crazy and extremists, and no one has to agree with them. Even Netanyahu claims that he doesn't agree with them, but behind the scenes they do what the government can't, which is they are the vanguard. They go steal the land, they go set up these outposts and trailer homes right on top of villages, and then they just wait for the military to set up the water lines, the power lines, and a base, and then they will provide security, and then it'll turn into the outpost turns into a settlement, and the settlement grows.
So it clearly is organized. Isn't, with the state.
Very organized.
I mean, that's what Daniela Weiss said. I think that
Daniela Weiss said it,
the face of,
and
the
that's what was
movement.
Really and that's what I really appreciated about Louis Theroux's documentary, is that not only did it reveal the coordination with the government, that she was like, I got Netanyahu's aide on speed dial, like, they love me. But aside from that, I thought he did a really good depiction of just the occupation. I mean, going to Hebron, seeing that visceral nature of Israeli apartheid, the ghost city, the caged settlements where they just throw excrement and bottles of piss and stuff at Palestinians and every day. I thought that was really, really good. So all of that is to say that, you know, I did the exact same things that he did, minus talking to these crazy settler leaders. I went into Hebron. I went and talked to people who were fending off settler attacks, getting their homes firebombed, their kids killed from settler attacks. So it was reminiscent of my time there. So I wasn't shocked. What I thought was, I think a curious element of the documentary was that everywhere he went in the West Bank, it showed like Israeli activists almost putting themselves on the front lines, almost like human shielding themselves in front of Palestinians to help them. That seemed slightly like off to me. I don't know if things have changed dramatically off October 7th, that like that people are actually there like helping on the front lines. But when I was there, I was startled by the lack of anyone, press, Israelis, like international activists. I was like, where is everyone? Like, every day there's attacks, every day there's violence, there's terrorism from the state.
They did say like the activists would, when the activists were there, they would, the settlers wouldn't attack or something, like
and look at what they just did to that Turkish girl, who they just executed her, I mean, because she was trying to block it. So it's like they're ramping it up and they don't care. I think they got scared by Louis Theroux and maybe the BBC cameras, but they will kill activists.
I mean, Daniela Weiss, going back to that piece of work, she literally pushed him on camera.
Yes. Oh yeah, that was crazy. And she was like, I wish you pushed me back.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
this is exactly what you guys do.
Yeah,
you provoke, and then you film the response and say that it was self-defense. So, dude,
do you, so you know, this is almost a rhetorical thing, so you think that a two-state solution will never happen?
Absolutely not.
Right. What is, like, in what direction can we take it, or you know what?
Yeah.
What is the hope? You know.
Well, I think the biggest problem with the documentary is the interpretation of it from Zionists and from Israelis who say it's easy to go film the craziest people in the West Bank. Come film us. Come film what Israeli society is really like.
On the beach.
Yeah. And so that's the problem, is when everything like Bernie's rhetoric, painting it just like the Likudniks and Netanyahu, that's a problem. Mm. That's a problem, because it's almost like painting Trump as the aberration of American society. We know that he is an organic outgrowth of what the rot of our society. Mm. He's actually a perfect representation of who we are. Mm. This country, what we've done. Mm. And so Israel's the same way. Netanyahu represents what Zionism is.
Yes.
He's not just some crazy outlier. If he was, why is he still in fucking power, dude? God damn it. How come they can't get rid of that monster? It's like, yeah. I've never seen, like,
he's been prime minister.
How many elections? How many, like,
And then they'll say they're revolting against him and all that, or they were like protesting against him and all that. But then you see the protests and they're like straight up Israeli flags.
Oh, it's nationalistic as hell. I mean, my friends, for years I've been trying to tell people the left is non-existent in Israel. They have 10,000 strong fascist rallies chanting death to Arabs, death to the leftists. There's a mantra where they say the leftists are AIDS. Mm. Arabs are the common cold. Wow. You can't get rid of the common cold unless you get rid of the left. They're the final barrier.
Is the left
completion of the ethnic cleansing?
Exactly. So the left is like their biggest.
They will enemy? Go and like jump you. I mean,
you want peace, or you want equal rights.
Yeah. I mean, Gaia Dan, she's an extremely brave, brilliant anti-Zionist Israeli Jew. She has told me, corroborated the danger. They've tried to show Gaza Fights for Freedom. Her house was raided twice. Her parents were threatened. I mean, it's so crazy. She has corroborated that there are only a couple hundred anti-Zionist Israeli Jews in the entire country. They all know each other. All these mass rallies that we see, this is about the hostages. Yeah. If there were no hostages in Gaza, there wouldn't be any protests. And they are scared for their lives. They go out in the streets trying to protest, and they are scared equally from fascist thugs jumping them as they are the military response.
I mean, if they really wanted to even remotely look like they cared or they're standing for what's right, it's like you have to take such a large, extreme stance against your government that is so clearly condemning of what's happening to match the gravity of how terrible everything their own government's doing. And if it's not that type of stance, then you're not taking a stance.
Totally. I mean, and look, I get it. It's hard, you know, to reject Zionism growing up in Israel. It's a hard pill to swallow, but it needs to be done, because Zionism is a supremacist ideology based on death and suffering. And when people say, do Israel, oh, so you don't think Israel has the right to exist? So what they're really saying is they want an apartheid Jim Crow style government to exist. And no, that doesn't have the fucking right to exist.
Right. Or if they ever had a right to exist, which they didn't, they've forfeited it with their behavior and their, you know, genocide.
They need to dissolve the apartheid system and equalize everything, democratize the country. Every person has equal rights and equal voting rights. That's not a hard concept.
They have the right to coexist, but not to exist on top of us, on top of our graves.
Correct.
So, yeah. That's if you guys are listening, please give equal rights to everybody.
If you guys are listening,
it's easier said than done.
Thank you,
I mean,
first of all,
Talal's Palestinian. You know, his family is
from Gaza.
Originally from Gaza.
Wow.
Yeah, mom and dad.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So
I can really relate to the angst of looking at across the sea onto the shore and imagining. Touching.
Yeah, and like being friends with Talal, like, I'm Lebanese, I'm not as informed as he was. You are Palestinian, so I always defer to him and be like, okay, so what is it? What is your demand? What is your want? He's like, man, just being able to go back, like equal rights, stuff like that. But
yeah,
that's antithetical to what.
And Talal was saying, like, he's seeing it from, this shore to the other shore. How I wanted to ask you, Abby, like, how are the struggles here and the struggles in Palestine connected? How are all the systems of oppression kind of you know, equal. And what do you say to the people that like put their head in the sand here in the States where they don't believe that it's like coming here, you know?
Yeah. Like the imperial boomerang effect. I mean, the thing is you have to broaden your perspective to internationalism. You have to have an internationalist view and lens of the world because we're living in a global imperialist system, and imperialism affects everyone in the world. That's like when I say the scope and scale of the US military is unmatched, like I mean it. And that means that billions of people are living under the boot and dictates of my government and its horrific foreign policy. And that absolutely translates into death and misery at home. I mean, half of Americans can't afford, I mean, they're living paycheck to paycheck. They have no savings, bread, eggs, gas. When Biden is telling Americans that you have to like sacrifice at the pump to fight Putin, Americans don't resonate with that at all. And so people need to understand that oppression anywhere is oppression everywhere. Suffering anywhere is suffering everywhere. It's all part of the same global system. The U.S. military is the enforcer and protector of capitalism, global capitalism. And it's causing widespread death and suffering around the world. And I cannot sit by and watch it happen. I mean, let's just look at Standing Rock, because you brought up Standing Rock. And I think this is a perfect example. Because not only is it the obvious comparison of an indigenous people trying to have self-determination and take ownership of their land, just like Palestinians, but even more so, which links the two struggles, is the, on the flip side, the U.S. maintenance of fossil fuel. Right? I mean, look at Gaza, the keystone of fossil fuel infrastructure in the Middle East. Israel is the military garrison to protect the fossil fuel routes, the trade routes to get the resources. Standing Rock was about a pipeline. They were trying to protest this pipeline.
You're saying Gaza with the natural gas off with the
and just the oil, just the positioning of where it is in the geostrategic resources in the area,
connecting Egypt to Asia.
I have a quote from you. I think capitalism is the cage, but we're the birds with keys in our beaks.
Oh,
is that,
God,
is that you?
I wish it was. That's poetic as hell.
Wow.
Let's just pretend
it's a
it
great
was.
Quote, Abby.
That
was
wow. Thank you.
That was Abir Martin.
That was Abir.
No.
Yeah.
That was my doppelganger.
Yeah. And obviously, you're very outspoken. You have you're not afraid. Well, maybe you are afraid of being blacklisted, but it doesn't matter to you. You still continue with the blacklisting, you know, looming over your head. Whereas even to the point where like politicians have tried to silence you. Do you want to? Yeah. Extrapolate on
wait, what happened?
So, I mean, neocons, let's just say neocons hate me for good reasons. Zionists and neocons.
What does that mean? Is that
Empire
something
like
the Matrix?
neocons are neoconservatives. It's basically the political ideology that defined the Bush administration. And that's what defines a lot of the political establishment today. But neocons has become a bad word because it's been affiliated with these disastrous policies. But back
it's war,
when I, it's a,
right?
Yeah.
War lovers.
The people war lovers.
The people
exactly.
That read books upside down. And
yeah, it's it's the people who love war and who really believe in American exceptionalism.
And neolibs are the ones who love war, but it has a LGBT flag on it.
Yes, yeah. Okay. They think representation is progress, and that's it, and that's where it ends. Yeah. They love the status quo as long as they're doing good. Yeah, no, really crazy. When I first started in D.C. at Russia Today, I just remember I was like, oh, anyone, you know, you see Medea Benjamin in the halls of Congress all the time, just like yelling at Ben Gavir and shit. And I'm like, oh, I was like, I guess anyone can just like walk through. And so I was walking and everyone can walk through. That's
really?
A thing. Yeah. It's all like public, which is so crazy that not more people do that.
Yeah.
Like, why
Shout
is it only
Code
her?
Pink. Code Pink.
Give her some backup, bro.
Yeah.
She's too small. She needs help.
It's like walking with them from building to building.
But I saw Rand Paul just like randomly walking by me. And I was just like, Rand, Congressman or Senator. I was like, why did you just endorse Mitt Romney? Because he had just kind of jumped in the game. He was branding himself as like this libertarian hero.
Yeah,
and his dad infamously
like his father,
calls for closing down all the military bases, ending the empire. So I was like,
he was cool.
I was like, wait, Mitt Romney is like a monster. Why did you just endorse him? And he just like walked past and whatever. I thought the end of it. I was filming it. So it you know, it got a lot of views on YouTube. The next day, the Capitol Police called RT and just said, we're going to arrest Abby for stalking and harassment.
Wow. Mm.
stalking and harassment. I was like, so they have him arrest me. I was like, that'd be great TV, dude. Get all the cameras out. Let's. But instead, they set up this closed door meeting with me with all the bureau chiefs of the corporate media institutions in the Capitol. And they were like, this is not how it works. Okay. It's all about access and it's about building access and you need to get permission. And it was just all very like, you're not playing by the rules, sweetheart.
What are the rules?
You don't play by the rules. It's all access. No. It's access journalism. You don't step on toes.
Oh, so.
Oh, you make friends with everyone.
Oh.
You don't. No. Cause then you don't get in the club and you don't get in the press briefing.
You don't ask the bad questions. Yep. You don't ask the controversial questions.
So right out of the gate, they're like, oh, no. This is not what we've worked for years for. I remember that quote. We have worked for years for this access. Mm. I was like, oh, my God. So it was very revealing. And then, you know, for people who are listening who are like, wait, you worked at Russia Today? Hold on. It was 10 years before it was a national news scandal. And also during the Crimea incursion, I remember Russia Today was playing all this propaganda. And it reminded me of the Iraq War again. And even though it's a totally different context, I just felt really gross working there at that moment. And I was like, you know what? I don't feel good. And so I went to my boss and I was like, I'm going to quit unless you let me say this thing on air about why I disagree with this coverage. Mm-hmm. And he was like, okay. And so I made a statement against the network and against Russia. And what was fascinating about that is that I had no idea it was going to get viral or anything. I just wanted to say it for my own, like, my own peace of mind.
Yeah.
Because I just would feel like a hypocrite. I'm out there denouncing America all the time. And it's like, I don't agree with what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I was ready to lose my job over it, to force my editorial freedom. Long story short, I became like an international hero in the Western media because they saw me as an anti-Russian insurgent on Russian media.
Let's go.
But I didn't play by their rules. So they trotted me out immediately. They're like, ooh, like not looking into me at all. They're like, ooh, great. Let's pluck her up. Throw her on CNN to talk shit about RT and throw it under the bus as a propaganda network. And so I didn't play by their rules. I just, when I did go on these stations, I was like, no different from you guys during the Iraq War. What did CNN do? So flip the narrative immediately, went on NPR. I was like, why did you guys take a grant from BP? How did you cover the BP oil spill? So all of it, immediately I got.
Their dirty under.
And what was amazing about that is that I got smeared immediately. There was this huge neocon think tank circuit that sabotaged me and tried to bring me down because they realized I wasn't useful. So to see that kind of inner workings, like House of Cards style. There was a neocon think tank run by this Iraq war architect who saw what happened to me, saw the notoriety I got from making that statement. And so they went to another anchor at RT and they were like, you will get a job on CNN if you quit live on air, denounce Abby as like a lunatic.
Whoa.
And say that what she did was staged. Wow. And you make it even more dramatic by quitting live on air. And so she did. She did.
How much did you get paid?
Yeah.
I don't. What's sad is I don't even think she got paid. I think it was just the promise of getting
on CNN.
And it was so sad and so staged because you can see her like reading notes. Like this little lackey at this neocon think tank just gave her all the notes and was like, "Here, just read this." And so she goes on the search. She actually got on the Daily Show because it's so easy and formulaic. You just pluck a box. You're like, "I hate Russia."
Yeah.
And then they're like, here's the red carpet, sweetie. Say, you know, go wherever you want. And so she just doesn't know what to say because she had no political ideology or like no, it was just someone parroting to her. And so her life kind of fell apart and she never got a job, but it definitely did its purpose, which is they discredit me, call me the conspiracy theorist, call me the lunatic. It was horrible, but it really was amazing to see the lengths that they will go.
Yeah,
I have a layered question.
Truth is powerful.
Layered.
Go ahead.
So back to kind of what initially opened your eyes to Palestine, and the relevance of the flotilla going down again. You know, yesterday. So I remember very clearly when they attacked that, you know, Turkish from Turkey, the ship, the flotilla, and I remember being so disheartened that how can, you know, and this was in 2010, and how can like they so clearly violate a humanitarian aid ship with no major outrage and no, you know, the world not closing down on them? And I remember thinking like, this has got to turn some hearts, and sure enough,
turn mine.
It did. And so the other part of the question is, how can we continue to reach folks like yourself that are in America that, you know, might have not, might be conscious of, you know, political happenings in the world, but are sleeping on Palestine? Mm-hmm. And I guess the final part of the question is the fact that journalism is, or international journalists are outlawed from Gaza. Is that not the most craziest thing? And how can we tie it all together?
Yeah. You know, what's really disheartening, and then I'll go with what's optimistic. So don't get me yet. But what's disheartening about this, and speaking to my Palestinian friend about, you know, when the Ali Arab Hospital was bombed and they tried to blame Islamic Jihad and it was a failed rocket,
that whole thing.
Moment of media.
And then they bombed 15 more hospitals.
34.
The rest.
At the moment, I was just like, it was such a horrific moment, and it was so disgusting to see the media just run and cover for Israel. And I remember my friend, I was like, surely like this genocide is it. Like, mm-hmm. if people don't wake up from this, nothing will. And I was like, isn't that like, that's good, right? And he was just like, by the time everyone wakes up enough to change this, he's like, all Palestinians will be dead. All of our blood will have spilled. So no. And I felt so stupid asking that, because I was like, you know, during this moment, how dare I? But his words stuck with me so profoundly, because I was just like, the fact that it has taken this.
Yeah.
It has taken this. But we also have to look at, you know, on one hand, I want to look at the majority of Americans and I'm like, you have no excuse. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what's going on, you're a moron, like you're willfully ignorant.
Right.
You've taken a side, you're a monster, you have no empathy. Like at this point, you're selfish. Like I feel like
a lot of people are like, it doesn't have to do with me.
That's crazy.
Don't want to know about it.
That's crazy. I mean, you know,
we don't have health care here.
That's true.
It has nothing to do.
All money is going to Israel and Ukraine, so.
And I think on the flip side, I still have hope in the sense that I think the media is so complicit. Like, I just saw a Pew Research poll back in, I think, April 2024 that said that half of Americans didn't know if more Israelis had died than Palestinians.
Wow.
And whose fault is that?
Wow.
If these stories weren't buried, if the leads weren't buried, if the headlines were written not like painfully tortured haikus and they actually just pointed out the perpetrator who's doing these mass killings and massacres, no one would have any complications or confusion.
Right.
It's the media, and they need to be held accountable for genocide, and they're complicit because it really comes down to them. They are the ones who are derelict at the job, and we wouldn't be in the situation without them.
And if they were like better, you know what I'm saying?
Criminally truthful, complicit.
Yeah, the criminally complicit. If they had just told the truth, you know, people. It wouldn't be an argument.
That tells me that there's still a lot of ignorance around the topic, despite like some of the promising signs, like what happened in Seattle with Bernie and like people from Idaho. Was it Idaho or Seattle? One of the two.
What are you talking about? Big rally?
When Bernie Sanders was kind of yelled at in protest, mm-hmm. they ripped a Free Palestine flag from like the crowd, and then people started chanting Free Palestine at Bernie. Mm-hmm. And it was mostly white people, I think, in Idaho, I believe.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you guys didn't hear about that?
I know. I've heard about it. I just don't know exactly which city you're talking about.
Yeah, it was either Seattle or Boise. But anyway, so that was a sign that, you know, there's like regular Americans waking up. But it's still not enough.
100%. I mean, you see polling also of like sympathies toward Israel. They dropped like 20 points among Democrats, which is great. But it's like, dude. How is anyone supporting this? Yeah. Like, if you're a Democrat, what are you talking about here? If you even remotely consider yourself as a person who cares about quote unquote liberal values, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Right.
So at this point, anyone who's remotely educated, you are a monster if you are like a Zionist at this point. At what we have seen happen, I refuse to let these people be normalized in progressive spaces. Right.
You see it happen around the world. I mean, they're a pariah state.
Yep.
Anytime any Israeli leaves Israel, they feel the pressure.
Good.
So that we're going to hopefully keep applying that pressure. But I think we can wrap this up with one last question. is independent media the way to go?
Yes, of course. I mean, that's the only option that we have.
You can't work within the establishment?
Oh my God, no. I mean, the establishment, look, the way that the corporate media is structured might as well be state media in the US. And mm-hmm. and that's actually more dangerous, because at least in Russia, Pravda, everyone knew that it was a propaganda station. In Cuba, everyone knows the state controls. It's like people know China. It's like it's all out in the open. Here we have a surveillance grid from all these tech oligarchs. We have this PayPal mafia secretly like controlling our reality, curating our reality with these algorithms. It's very scary. But beyond that, I mean, the corporate media acts as an arm of the state. And so they cannot be trusted when it comes to foreign policy at all.
Yeah.
All the people who rise in the ranks of these institutions that set the editorial line, they are Zionists, empire babies, and they are imperialists, and they cannot be trusted. Running these institutions, they simply won't allow these views. You would never get a job at these publications if you believed counter to what the dominant narrative is.
It goes back to the access, right?
Goes back to
I
the
mean,
access.
If you ever see any interview on these so-called stations, and they'll first, if like a guest says, oh, the genocide, and then they're like, oh, whoa. We don't say genocide.
Palestine.
Yeah, we don't say that word on CNN or BBC or whatever. So it is like controlled from that perspective. Like they'll at least, like they'll let the person talk and then be like, well, Israel would say this. Right. You know, it's like,
well, that's
why
opinion.
Are you saying that? Yeah.
Like the New York Times is like the liberal Bible. It's everywhere in goddamn Portland where I live. And the New York Times has been the worst perpetrator of propaganda throughout this whole genocide. And it's unforgivable. I mean, your point about you can't say this, you can't say that. Literally a style guide was revealed mm-hmm. within the New York Times that said that they ordered their staff. They can't say the word genocide. They can't say the word ethnic cleansing, and they can't say the word occupation.
Yeah.
So they're literally using the guidelines of this paper of record to cover and absolve Israel's crimes on paper.
And they're saying what they are. Yeah. Like, don't talk about our occupation. I mean, they even said, like, don't say Palestine. Say, like, Palestinian.
Say occupied territories. They
or,
can't say Palestine.
Yeah, or, like, you know, the Hamas-controlled Gaza Health Ministry or whatever. Stuff like that. It's like,
yeah,
so what, they didn't die?
But title, like, the headlines are as you said, like haikus of like
haikus,
stupidity,
yeah.
Basically. Like they dot the
yeah, yeah.
Words matter. And
15 people, workers allegedly
unalive like,
drone
by
strike,
you know.
Palestinians drop dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
Mass.
Yeah.
But let me
15 have lost
positive.
Their lives.
Yeah,
where did
tragically.
The live go? We need a search party.
Well, I'll never forget this one. During the 2014 bombing campaign, New York Times real article headline. Missile finds patrons watching World Cup at cafe.
What?
As if the missile was like an autonomous person being like, hey guys, where's all the people at?
Yeah. Whoop. There you are. Boom.
Yeah.
What the
are you rooting for Argentina?
I mean, but
that's,
let me just, I don't want to end on like
optimism.
A. Yeah.
Okay, what's
optimism.
Next for you? What's, you know, let's
well,
get some hope.
It is hard
let's
to
end
be
with
optimistic.
Optimism about where we're at.
Yes.
PR war, right? I mean, look, Israel spent billions of dollars over the course of its existence trying to flip reality on its head. And so far, it worked. It ain't working anymore.
Mm.
It is
they're
forever.
Never recovering.
They are never. Right now, once you have every human rights organization that is revered by liberal institutions and liberals in general, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, everyone is on board, including B'Tselem, including Israeli human rights organizations, saying Israel's an apartheid state committing genocide. Live streaming genocide. All of these human rights organizations have now gone, it's all uniform, it's all unanimous. Now the narrative is what has to be done to stop Israel and to make apartheid fall.
Mm. Yeah,
without the genocide, apartheid's a crime against humanity.
Yeah,
and so these are huge, grievous crimes, and they need to be stopped. And so the international world, even though we're seeing complete inaction from politicians, the consensus is...
Yeah, staggering.
It's staggering.
That's good.
And and I think that we've seen tens of millions of people around the world form a movement like I have never seen before. You know, I went out in the streets during the Iraq War, and that was different to me because that was my country invading Iraq.
Yeah.
This, like you said, people don't see the link,
mm-hmm.
even though it is so obvious that it's a U.S.-Israeli genocide. But I think the fact that so many Americans care, that is motivating to me. Americans are selfish in general. And we're empire babies. We think we're the best. We're privileged as fuck. So to see this many Americans getting out of their privilege, putting their bodies on the line, that's beautiful. It's beautiful. And having that international solidarity, realizing that this struggle is the same as Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is the same as the immigrants getting rounded up by ICE. It's the same as the Yemeni children being starved by our bombs. It's the same as the Palestinians digging through rubble. All of it's the same. It's the same as the homeless person on the street corner that I just saw walking in here. All of these struggles are linked. We have to realize that, and we have to act accordingly. Our lives are on the line. Our planet is on the line. Yes. These monsters, we can't let them win. We're going to let these motherfuckers win? No, we got to fight.
I'm ready to run through a fucking brick wall.
No other choice, dude. Let's go.
We got to come together. Yeah. We have to stick together.
I mean, yeah.
Intersectional solidarity is definitely missing, I feel like, but lacking, but it's there. But we got to be stronger. Sure.
And shout out to the Palestinian journalists, because if it weren't for them, who knows where we'd be? If it weren't for their sacrifice, 200 that showed us the truth.
Yeah,
they showed us the truth.
Yeah,
200 journalists
that died. They
targeted most of them.
Yeah, and what's next for you?
Earth's Greatest Enemy is going on a theater tour. I hope to see all of you there.
Absolutely.
Love you guys.
Where are we?
So fun.
Coming to LA or what?
LA. Yeah, we're doing a theater tour. We're going to try to use it. Like, we don't want to go the film festival circuit. I don't want to make this into some like vanity project of like, I don't give a shit about any of that.
You just want people
this
to see
is
it.
This is a movie that I need to be a catalyst. We need people to act, and we need to link this together. I need the environmental movement to know that we can't go anywhere unless we defeat U.S. militarism. This is the elephant in the room.
Put it on a Watermelon Plus. Yeah, streaming.
So I'm stoked for that, and I hope it's the beginning of a mass awakening, and I hope we can just continue to deepen our consciousness and build this solidarity with our brothers and sisters who are suffering. This is wrong. This needs to end now. The fact that this is happening in the year 2025, that starvation of children.
It's insane.
I cannot wrap my mind around it. I really can't.
It's insane.
And so I think I trust people's humanity and empathy, and I really do believe, and that's my whole life's work, is education, political education. They have tried so hard to lobotomize us.
Yeah.
And it is an act of resistance to just learn the radical truth. Let it mobilize you. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Eyes wide open, baby. Mm-hmm. I want to see eyes wide open. Mm-hmm. I don't want to fucking have rose-colored glasses on. I want to see the truth. Because unless we know the truth, we don't know how to stop this.
Right.
The truth is depressing, though.
Yeah, but you're not living.
It's beautiful. You're not really living. You know, because once you see the truth, it's like then everything becomes so... becomes so much more beautiful to me. I'm like, I appreciate nature so much more. Like, I look at my kids, it's like knowing the privilege and the luck of having these two beautiful kids who the geographical luck of being born here. Mm-hmm, and I try to live moment to moment with them because I know what's happening.
The world they exist in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why you moved to Portland. Because they're like, let's legalize shrooms.
Honestly,
and
Portland,
you're like, let's go.
Portland seems an amazing, like, just like the nature there and the sea and the forest. I mean, the ocean and the forest.
And when you ask me, how do I, you're like, you seem so positive and stuff. It's like, man, this is LA kind of drags, because when you don't have that connection with just trees, and it might sound so lame.
No, I feel
we like. Are animals, like like being and just looking at moss and like touching it.
Yeah.
And my son just being like, this is so trippy. Like looking at the tree. Yeah. And I'm just like, this is life. Yeah. Like this is so fucking beautiful, man. Like
moss.
Yeah, like the banana slugs and all the cool critters that come up in Portland, and just like being able to just escape. It's so necessary and it's so beautiful. And I encourage everyone to just dig into yourself. If you know, anyone can be an artist. Anyone can do whatever that makes you feel good. Just do what makes you feel good, you know, because it's really heavy.
Yeah.
It's hard to
I think when we all out. When we all follow that inner truth, we will inevitably find the external truth and be able to accomplish what it is that, you know, we're setting out to and what you're talking about. And your passion is obviously extremely felt. I mean, the studio has never felt this like alive and solemn at the same time. And so I can't thank you for your, you know, solidarity and work and incredible just and self and
which, you know, don't like we're only as an activist is only as good as their energy, right? Like if you're exhausted, you're not, you know, beneficial to the cause. So we got to recharge, we got to lean on community and you know, take the advice of like go touch grass, you know what I mean? So Abby, like this and then, was
sorry, yeah, one last thing. Yeah. For the political like political future, you know, like progressive movement has like it's not really existing, you know, they had this whole oligarchy fight oligarchy tour that doesn't really say anything. Like what do you recommend for people like politically, cuz it's pretty obvious who supports what's going on and what isn't, you know, like
yeah,
how do we move forward, how can we organize better to get actual progressive people in there?
Well, I think this is actually a good moment, especially what happened with the election. It's a great radicalizing moment because of the failure of I mean, they could have easily had Kamala differentiate herself, they could have easily won the election.
Yeah,
they didn't even fucking try. And I think that showing people, especially young people, there is no hope within this system. We saw AOC lie to our fucking face.
Yeah,
working tirelessly for a ceasefire.
Yeah,
she's toast. Dude, she torched her career. Yeah. She, you know, like trying to run for president, good luck.
Right.
So I think that young people know. And I think that they are completely detaching. I mean, yes, of course, there's exciting energy because Bernie, out of all the people in Congress, at least he's sane. He's trying to stop. I mean, at least he's trying to stop transferring arms, even though it's a horrible position and won't even say the word genocide. So it's hard. It's like, are the people at these mass rallies investing in the Democratic Party, or they just really like Bernie's energy and whatnot? So it's hard to tell there. But I think investing any ounce of energy into electoralism, especially on a federal level, is a dead end, 100%. I think the movement, the beautiful revolutionary struggles that I see happening, the mobilizations, the mass education efforts with all of the marginalized communities that are being impacted by U.S. policies is the future. And that's the love. That's the friendship and the family.
Yeah.
People who are atomized and isolated in this society, that's what they want you to be. These, I just saw fucking Mark Zuckerberg being like, my whole plan is to just make, he's like, people want friends. He's like, I'm going to make you AI friends. They want, every time you get trapped in the phone, you're given that, you're given your time.
Yeah.
That's what
Elon Musk, man.
Right. That's the, it's not gold anymore. That's the high, like the most expensive commodity. It's
attention.
It's data and attention.
Exactly.
So,
just, and that's the opposite of grass and trees.
Yeah, go fucking touch grass, you know, like so.
And more Rashida Tlaib's.
Yeah, right. What a saint. And what, listen to the Habibi podcast. Listen to this podcast and then go for a hike.
Yeah.
Doom scrolling.
Yeah. Or do both at the same time.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm so excited for the listeners to hear this episode. Yeah, this was amazing. Thank you so much for taking time to come out.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm glad we could make your LA return possible.
So honored.
Which hotel are you staying in?
The Pali Hotel, baby.
We're going to release this not right now. So people.
Pali Hotel?
Yeah. My stalker listening?
Yeah.
Abby Martin, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Abby.
Amazing.
Thank you guys so much. Shout out, Corey. Dude, we could have done 3 hours.
I know, right?
I know.
Oh, yeah, and thank you, Corey.
It was fun as hell.